Richard Herring takes up the challenge to reclaim objects we've vilified.
It's Richard Herring's objective. And please welcome Richard Herring.
Thank you. Hello.
Thank you. Hello and welcome to the third episode of Richard Herring's Objective, a series in which I attempt to claim the unclaimable, consecrate the desecrated, and turn objectionable articles into objets d'art. I am going through the dustbin of history to see what discarded treasures I can claim as salvage. I'm like the offspring of an urban fox who had sex with a womble. And let's face it, that must have happened at some point. Orinoco was asking for it. Underground or overground, wombling for free. Puppet whore. This is a show that aims to fight prejudice of all kinds. And it's nice, it's great to see so many women in the audience today. It's lovely when women feel they can come out and see the comedy with the men. Oh, no, don't worry, I'm not one of these sexist women-hating comedians. I despise all that. I'm not sexist. I love women. I'm not a sexist. I've actually got a friend who's a woman. I can't be sexist. I strongly believe that women should be treated as if they're equal. That is... To prove how unsexist I am, I actually have a woman person helping me out on this show. I mean, I do most of it, but she's allowed to do some funny voices and clean up my dressing room after we finished. It's TV's Emma Kennedy! Hello, Emma, you're right.
Hello, yeah, so, who's this friend you've got who's a woman? You know, mums don't count.
Thank you very much. Already in this series, I have wrestled Hitler to the ground, kicked him in the ball, and taken away his moustache from him. And I've made the Radio 4 hoodie the most fashionable item of clothing on this year's catwalks. But which object are we going to be objective about this week? And remember, if you want to play along at home, please cover your ears now and keep them covered until I tell you to listen again. The ear-covering idiots. How will they hear me? They'll have to go around with their ears covered forever now. This isn't even something you can even play along at home with anyway. You idiots, I hate you. You can't hear me. Bad luck. Anyway, here's this week's object.
St. George's flag.
Pray God for Harry, England and St. George!
Yes, the national flag of England, a red cross on a white background, which many people associate with the far right, football hooligans, and over-optimistic idiots who hubristically fit them onto their wing mirrors at the start of the World Cup, only to have to shamefacedly remove them under the dead of night 3 days later when England have lost 3-0 to Sildavia. There's nothing more humiliating than losing to a fictional country from a Tintin book. But if anyone can do it, England can. Ooh, 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 King Otaka's army. Anyway, before we start, I feel I have to apologise to any listeners in Scotland, Wales or Ireland, because this week I'm going to be talking about England and what it means to be English. But that's interesting in itself, don't you think? The fact the first thing I feel I have to do when talking about my country is to apologise. If a Scottish person was doing a show about being Scottish, do you think that would happen?
And today the show is about how great it is being Scottish, eating shortbread and haggis, wearing kilts, playing bagpipes, and listening to the music of Susan Boyle. Oh, Subo. Oh my goodness. I just thought how annoying that'll be for English people. Oh, no, did no one consider the feelings of the English? Oh, how embarrassing. We don't want to upset English people, do we, the new? Oh!
In fact, it is actually impossible to say we apologise to the English in a Scottish accent without it sounding sarcastic or it actually being sarcastic. But as an Englishman, I feel duty-bound to say sorry for talking about my country before I've even started. We begin on the back foot with the assumption that being English is an awful or embarrassing thing to be. Is this the root of why we feel like we do about our national flag? Shame and guilt. Believe me, as a white middle-class man who went to Oxford University, I know all about what it is to feel contrite and ashamed about everything I am. Pity me, no one is more accursed and despised than I. But shouldn't equality be about allowing everyone to celebrate who they are? And is anyone stopping the English from celebrating but themselves? Do we even care about St. George or know when his day is? I went out on the streets of London to find out. Do you know what day St George's Day is?
More or less, but I couldn't tell you the exact date.
When do you think it is?
It's around... I think it's in April, May.
No. I can't say that I do, no.
No, it's travesty, isn't it? I'm really embarrassed.
You know, no one does. Do you know when St George's Day is?
Nah, I don't. I mean, like, you need to get a day off for that kind of thing, but we don't get that, do we?
No, I think it's in April, is it?
Yeah, it is in
April. I can't remember the actual date.
Do you know when St George's Day is?
Oh, I should, shouldn't I? That's really bad. No, is the short answer.
So do you celebrate St George's Day?
Inwardly.
On a day she doesn't know when it is, she inwardly... So no-one... We went out and we asked about 10 or 15 people and no-one knew. Brilliant. So let's take a look at St George and his flag a little more closely, because nothing could be more English than St George, could it? Except for the fact that St George was probably from Cappadocia in what is now Turkey, the son of a Roman soldier and a Palestinian. How did he get to be England's saint? Wasn't there an English candidate?
So, King Richard, it's time to choose England's patron saint.
It is a solemn and important choice. What are the candidates?
St. Edmund of East Anglia.
Edmund? Really, that's a bit of a sissy name, isn't it? It's like Edward crossed with Rosamond. We can't have a saint called that.
Yeah, but he was shot to death with arrows by Danes. He was Edmund the Martyr.
No, we can't have him. Our Muslim enemies will call him Edmund Tomata. We can't have that. It'll make us look stupid.
All right, next candidate, St. Cuthbert of Lindisfarne.
Cuthbert? Were you listening? Cuthbert's worse than Edmund. It sounds like the school SWAT. I can't shout, cry God for England and St. Cuthbert, can I? And the Muslims will call him St. Custard. What did he do?
Well, he's from Northumbria, lived like a hermit in a cave and protected ducks.
You need someone who did something more exciting than introducing bird protection laws.
Very well, very well. Well, the last one's a good one. St. Alban.
No, that's a place, not a saint.
No, the place was named after him because he was beheaded there.
Is that all he did? Got beheaded? Anyone can do that. St. Alban. The Muslims will call him St. Ballbum. It will destroy our morale. Don't we have a saint with a nice, normal English name who did something cool and didn't just look after birds or get killed for having a stupid girly name?
No, not really.
Oh, look, what about this one on the list? St. George, that's a good English name.
He's from Palestine.
What did he do?
Nothing, really.
I can tell you're lying.
No, all right, he killed a dragon.
He killed a dragon? Now we're talking. He is England's patron saint.
He's not English.
Look, we've lost all our battles with an English saint in charge. I think if we get a foreign man in the job, we might finally win something. And that's what really happened. That's how we ended up with a foreign patron saint who clearly never did the thing he's most famous for, if you think about it for a second. Dragons are not real. There's a possibility it was a crocodile. But if we're going to have a patron saint who was foreign and had dominion over crocodiles, then I think we should at least go for Steve Irwin. Or Paul Hogan. At least they spoke English and were descended from English criminals. But is the flag any more English than St. George? To find out a bit more about the history of the flag, I talked to vexillologist, which means a flag expert, and he can also make them talk without moving his lips. It's Graham Bartram.
National flags as we know them today are really quite a recent concept. Way back in the early Middle Ages, if not before, countries started using flags to indicate their ships. But it was really only in the later 20th century that the idea of a regulated, you know, that is the national flag of this country, really came into being.
Because I'd heard that maybe there were countries or towns that had the flag before England. Genoa, I'd heard, had it first.
Yes, as I said, St. George's cult was very widely spread. And places like Genoa, Aragon, Catalonia all used that flag. And, of course, Georgia used that flag and still does to this day.
So we've got a foreign saint with a foreign flag. Weird that it's associated with English nationalists and racists. But should we be worried about the racist associations of the flag? And is racism as bad as everyone makes out? What I'm saying on Radio 4 at tea time is... maybe racists have a point. Bear with me on this one. First of all, are there any racists in tonight just by cheering? I'm not sure they really even exist, these racists. In reality, I'm actually a woolly liberal. I'm guessing that you think the same as me, you listen to Radio 4. What I believe is that everyone in the world is the same and should be treated the same regardless of their race, their sex, their sexuality, which is a nice way of looking at things. But I've got this friend, right? His dad is English, but his mum is from Asia somewhere. Okay. I can never quite remember exactly where she's from. It's either Malaysia or Indonesia or the Philippines. He's one of my best friends. I should know his heritage. It's a source of massive embarrassment and liberal guilt to me that I don't know where he's from. But if you think about it, to a racist, he's just Chinese. That's that sorted. It doesn't matter that his dad's English. It doesn't matter that his mum's not Chinese. He's Chinese, that's that problem sorted. Let's move on with our lives. In fact, to a racist, pretty much anyone from Hawaii, right through Fiji, up through all those Australasian islands, Vietnam, Thailand, Siberia even, China and Tibet, they're all Chinese. One in four of the world's population, immediately just exactly the same. I mean, is that ugly or is that kind of beautiful? Because now you and I, we see the world as 195 different countries, 195 distinct types of people. To a racist, there are just four types of people. They're 191 closer than you to seeing everyone in the world as exactly the same. That's... which is what you want. The racist is better at being liberal than you are, Radio 4 listener. There's four types to the racist. There's Chinese, obviously. There's black, there's white. The fourth type is amazing. It's a beautiful vision of a utopian future. The fourth type basically encompasses anyone from the Indian subcontinent, right through the Middle East, North Africa, Southern Europe even, right through to Mexico, the Hispanic parts of South America. This vast swathe of humanity, all exactly, basically anyone who could be played by the actor Nadeem Sawalha. To a racist or a casting director, there is no difference. They can see no difference. You could be from El Salvador or Iraq. You're the same. Isn't that what you want? In fact, look at the people of India and Pakistan. Right? They hate each other. They're always fighting. There could be nuclear war between those two countries that will destroy the world. If only the people of India and Pakistan could see themselves the way a racist sees them. They go, what are we doing? Why are we fighting? I'm a Paki, you're a Paki. No, I'm from India, mate. Yeah, you're still a Paki, though. I mean, I'm not being rude. I don't like the name. Most of the world's wars and confrontations happen between peoples that racists would see as identical. Muslims and Jews, they're all pork dodgers. What are they arguing about? Northern Ireland, Southern Ireland, they're all paddies. What are they arguing about? They're crazy, aren't they? In fact, the most extreme racists see the world as just two types of people. You're either white or you're black. They're just one step away. Just one mental leap to make, and everyone in the world is exactly the same. You at home, you're 194 steps away from that utopia, yet you dare judge them, you. You make me sick. It's weird, though. Other nationalities can be proud of where they're from without being seen as racist. But is the association between the St. George flag and right-wing politics even justified? Not according to vexillologist Graham.
Until about 1996, the English didn't really use St. George's flag a great deal. And I'd be very surprised to see a crowd of football hooligans waving it until the European Cup.
Right.
And it was the European Cup in 1996, which was held, of course, in England. One of the competing nations was Scotland, and it suddenly occurred to the English supporters that waving their usual Union flags meant they were supporting both teams, and at that point they switched over to using a St. George's cross.
So at the moment, the St. George's flag is used in a fun way to signify that brief period of time that our football team survives in a major tournament. Like in the case of Darren Luxton, a pub landlord from Plymouth, who for the 2010 World Cup went to the trouble of buying a massive 50-foot by 25-foot St. George's flag to put on the roof of his pub. He said,
I'm extremely patriotic and love the World Cup. I'm going big on the World Cup this year and really getting into the spirit. There's been a constant stream of people pulling up and taking photos. It's a talking point of the town.
Must have cost him a fair bit to buy a flag, and it took scaffolders 2 hours to put it up. And I know from personal experience, they don't come cheap, those guys. What a statement of national pride. Darren added,
we should celebrate our team. This is our country, and I don't see why I shouldn't fly the England flag. England are gonna win the World Cup!
All that trouble. It must have been embarrassing enough to do the walk of shame to take the flag off a car, but having to call back the scaffolders earlier than the original appointment you'd made, it becomes a fitting symbol for the folly of this country's World Cup hopes, plus probably of what it is to be English, that hope over expectation. If we dare to dream, we are pretty much guaranteed humiliation. Although, again, it is quite interesting that Darren felt the need to say,
this is our country and I don't see why I shouldn't fly the England flag.
As if in the back of his mind there was something or someone who was going to stop him doing that. Is there some campaign or conspiracy to prevent us celebrating our Englishness? I asked journalist Gary Bushell about his views of St George's Day.
I think it's a disease that started many, many years ago. I think Orwell said it originally, that the English are the only great nationality. These intellectuals actually hate their own country. I'm paraphrasing there. But that inbuilt distrust or dislike of patriotism runs through what I'd call the chatterati, the middle-class liberal intelligentsia, the Guardian reading classes.
But, I mean, people can still celebrate it and they don't choose to do that. No one's actually stopping them celebrating.
Well, they do, actually. And it's overlooked. I mean, you go to certain mining villages where it's always been part of their tradition. It's certainly in the East End of London, everywhere, of course, apart from the Queen Vic.
I never thought I'd hear myself saying this sentence, but maybe Gary Bushell is right about that. As a liberal middle-class person, I suppose I am one of the Guardian reading people he talks about. There is a part of me that associates the St. George Cross with things from England's past, like the Crusades, the Empire, and what we did to that poor old Australian, Braveheart, which it seems at odds with our multicultural present. You just need to go down to Trafalgar Square in the heart of our capital and look at the statues there to see how we English are meant to see ourselves and how we've been defined by who we choose to honour. There's one there you're probably aware of, Nelson. That's probably worth keeping. He was quite a good guy, even if it is on a podium so high that it almost looks sarcastic, doesn't it? Look how important he is. So important that you can't actually see him. But what are the other three? I mean, there are four statue play podiums there. We all know they keep changing one of them. But what of the other three main statues? There's one of George IV. He's there, who at least was a king, but he's generally acknowledged as one of the worst monarchs this country has ever had. The other two are Charles James Napier and Henry Havelock. Yeah, you know them. All the amazing English people, all Britons, who could be celebrated in this square, and yet these chumps get to be there. It's a disgrace. Charles Napier, in case you haven't heard of him in that unlikely event, he was a British general who helped conquer Pakistan in the 19th century. He was famous for saying this.
The best way to quiet a country is a good thrashing, followed by great kindness afterwards. Even the wildest chaps are thus tamed.
Nice. representing you, England, he deserves a statue. Henry Havelock, I don't need to tell you why he's there, because underneath his statue it says,
soldiers, your labours, your privations, your sufferings and your valour will not be forgotten by a grateful country.
And they haven't been, have they? Because we all know what he and his soldiers did, don't we? Looks like the country isn't as grateful as it once was. Oh, hubris, thy name is Henry Havelock. He helped, of course, crush the Indian Mutiny of 1857 before himself, unfortunately, dying of dysentery. Yeah, it's the fourth plinth where we keep changing the statue, and these ones are secure. The fat, useless king and the men who killed Indians and Pakistanis, which doesn't seem to be in the right spirit of Englishness today. Is it because this is how we project our Englishness that any decently minded modern English person is bound to be embarrassed? Maybe one option to break unpleasant associations would be to redesign the English flag, create a new one for a new millennium. Graham has designed some flags himself. I asked him which ones.
Antarctica. That was an interesting
one. Is that just a white flag?
No, it's a blue flag. UN blue flag with a white map of Antarctica in the middle. It's very simple.
Rubbish. I'd have just done white to represent the snow. And it's easy. You just hand in a piece of paper.
Yeah, and then everyone would have thought you were surrendering every time you flew.
Also, the problem with that one might be that it'd be difficult to see in a snowy environment, but... Well, he also he designed a new Falklands flag. I asked him what changes he made to that.
The Falkland Islands flag used to be what's called a blue ensign, a blue flag with a Union flag in the corner, and it used to have a little white disc in the middle of the blue area with the coat of arms in it. Mm-hmm. The problem was we had several flags that were blue with a Union flag in the corner with a little white disc and a coat of arms in the middle, and you couldn't tell one from the other at the bottom of the flagpole. and my job at the time was working for the Admiralty, and we decided that we would fix this so that we could actually tell which flags they were, and we made the coat of arms a lot bigger and got rid of the white disc.
You know what I'd have done?
What?
Argentinian flag with a cross through it.
Graham thought that the Falkland Islands wouldn't want an Argentinian flag on them. I think that's good. It would send out a message to the Argentinians. It's a flag that both would upset the Falkland Islands and the Argentinians. It's brilliant. It may be why I'm not designing many flags, but I did have one radical alteration to the England flag in mind.
Can you write England across it, and does that make it a different flag?
You can write England across it. I wouldn't recommend it, because on the other side it says Dungler.
That's a good point. You don't want that, do you? Denagling. So maybe it would be a step forward if we saw ourselves as British rather than English. Is it harder to have an English sense of identity? Because unlike the Welsh, we don't have those things that define us, the singing, those stupid hats with the top cut off. And unlike the Scottish, we don't have tartan, haggis and kilts. We have no uniform symbols of Englishness. Gary Bushell is having none of that.
The ironic thing is, of course, that most of those things you talk about Scotland aren't Scottish in origin. You know, not even the tartan Scottish, it's French.
Perhaps the reluctance to make a fuss of St George and his day and our flag is nothing to do with the shame or our class. It's just down to our English national character. I talked to social anthropologist Kate Fox.
I think we're not really ashamed that we're secretly actually quite proud, but that we have a lot of... And this is about the flag as well. We have a lot of unwritten rules, things like modesty and moderation and humour, that prohibit any display or exhibition of national pride. I mean, I think, ironically, actually, the English, probably of all nations, have the least need for a national flag. In fact, patriotic flag waving offends against some of the most fundamental rules of Englishness.
According to Kate, there are 10 rules of Englishness.
Namely, I think, 3 of the 10 that I identified in my research, which are humour, moderation and modesty. Humour, I think, is one of our reflexes. It's almost a knee-jerk response. It's something that I call the importance of not being earnest rule. And the kind of, in other nations, the national flag evokes patriotic pride. Here we react with a kind of squeamish embarrassment, earnestness of any kind. Makes us squirm a bit, and I think patriotic earnestness of the flag-waving sort, a bit like religious zeal, makes us even more uncomfortable and twitchy. I mean, if you look at the example, you know, the kind of hand-on-heart, gushing, tearful acceptance speeches of American actors at the Oscars and other awards ceremony, you know, you don't see English politicians or actors or whatever indulging in this, because quite frankly, the response would be something that I've come to call our national catchphrase, which would be, oh, come off it.
That makes more sense, though, that the English are too modest, too mocking, too self-deprecating to take flag-waving or nationalism that seriously. The difference in English patriotism and American patriotism is evident from the way we treat our flags. Vexillologist Graham Bartram again.
Why do you think the flags have become so important that, like, people get upset if they're burned and defiled?
I think different countries have different feelings about their flags. Some countries use their flag as a very important part of their identity as a person. So in America, for instance, every morning in school, first thing they have to do, pledge allegiance to the flag. To them, it becomes an almost religious item. And they then get, understandably, very upset when people burn it or destroy it.
If a flag touches the ground, you then have to throw it away. Is that right?
Americans hate it when their flags touch the ground.
What do Americans do if their flag does touch the ground?
They have a special service, usually conducted by one of the veterans organisations or the Boy Scouts. They have prayers and they thank God for the use of this flag, and then they carefully cut it up into pieces so it's no longer the flag, and then they ritually burn it.
I don't think that's worse than just burning it. To cut it up and then burn it is worse than just burning
well,
it.
Well, by cutting it up, you're stopping it from being the flag.
But it's still the flag when you start cutting it up.
Yes.
The minute you put the scissors there, it's still the flag, and then you're cutting it up.
Yeah.
And then you set fire to it. But Americans are crazy, that's what I'm saying.
Okay, well, that's your opinion.
Yeah.
The British way of disposing of a flag is normally to put it in a plastic bag and then put it in the bin.
Would you rather be in a nation that gets furious if someone burns your flag but still burns your own flag after cutting it up because you're insane? Or in a nation where you think it's silly at worst to burn a flag, but good for flag sales at best? Like all nations, we've done stuff to be embarrassed about, but we've done loads of fantastic stuff. That's English, the spreading of democracy, social justice, creating music and literature, comedy and sport. That's what Gary thinks St George's Day should be celebrating.
It's one day a year where you can have a bit of a party, a bit of a knees up, a bit of a drink for England. This is not too extreme, I don't think. We should have great festivals, concerts, comedians, bands, a bit of ska, a bit of punk, anything you like, a bit of hard rock, all the things that we've contributed to the world. And of course, ska is obviously inherited from Jamaica, but it became part of our culture. We took to that as avidly as anything.
Seems it's not just the Scottish who like taking stuff off other people, but perhaps if our focus shifted from the historical idea of England as a great world power to a more realistic view of our modern-day reality, we'd be more willing to celebrate our flag and our day. Let's start at Trafalgar Square. Let's go down there, pull down those statues of forgotten idiots and unimportant kings and replace them with English people we can be proud of, or at least things that would make us laugh. How about honouring Shakespeare, for a start, or the Beatles, Emily Pankhurst, Sir William Beveridge, Jane Austen, J.K. Rowling. She's done all right for us, hasn't she? Lewis Hamilton, Nobby Stiles, Freddie Mercury, the cast of Are You Being Served, one of our finest exports. George Orwell, Trevor MacDonald, Alan Partridge, I think, would be better than Charles Napier. England is a country originally created by invasion of Northern Europeans. Our patron saint is the son of a Roman and a Palestinian. Our flag is from Genoa. Our royal banner is three lions, animals indigenous to Africa. The figurehead of the Church of England that we worship is a Palestinian Jew. We have a German royal family. Our football team has an Italian manager. Our national food's pretty much curry. We have citizens from nearly every nation on the earth. England is the world. Perhaps the way to celebrate Englishness and our national flag is to build on the St George's flag, as we already have done, to make the Union flag, then stick a dragon on it for Wales, probably the Guinness logo for Ireland, and then keep going, add in every flag of the world, putting in a detail from each, incorporating a colour or a line or a symbol, until we had an English flag that was also a flag of the world. I asked vexillologist Graham about that.
What do you think would happen if you put every flag on the world into one flag?
I can tell you what it looks like, because I've seen people do it. And the result is brown.
All right, that won't work then, I admit. That'd be a mess. We'd have a brown flag, which might give the Scottish some ammunition. So let's stick with the flag we've got and be happy that it represents a country that doesn't take itself too seriously, but which is inclusive and allows people to do and believe whatever they like as long as they don't hurt anyone else. We're defined by our sense of humour. Maybe we should have the official flag have England written in the middle, so from the back it reads the Naglani. Yeah, because it's funny, and flags are there to look pretty, to wave for fun, not to treat with more respect than you would give to a human being. Because maybe we don't want to devolve into tiny nation states, we want to evolve into a species that defines ourselves only as humans and as citizens of Britain, of Europe, of the world, of the solar system, of the universe, and of the mind of God. Thank you for listening. Good night.
You have been listening to Richard Herring's Objective, written by and starring Richard Herring with me, TV's Emma Kennedy. It was produced by Tanusha Galani.
And Richard Herring is back next week, reclaiming Dolly the Sheep.